This is the Horse Radio Network.
This is episode 106 of Horsemanship Radio, brought to you by Omega Fields, the world's best omega-3 supplements for horses. Horsemanship Radio is a part of the family of the Horse Radio Network. And today we have some really interesting people, not new to the horse industry, but really from different worlds in the horse industry. This is Debbie Laux, and you're listening to the Horsemanship Radio. Thanks for joining us. Horsemanship Radio airs on the 1st and the 15th of the month, and I have my producer, Jen, with me today. Hi, Coach Jen.
Greetings, Debbie. I've gotten to talk to you a lot this month because Glenn has gone off and is playing podcast pro at a conference, so you've been helping out on the Horses in the Morning show. This is fun.
Yeah, that was fun. I'm such a newbie at it, but you know, I don't make any pretense that I'm Glenn the Geek.
You own it. That's what makes you awesome, is you own
it. Oh, you're so sweet. No, Glenn the Geek will never be in my vernacular, but it was really fun. It was fun to join you and Jamie. I enjoyed that so much. And it's right here on Flagstaff Farms. How hard is that? Roll out of bed. You're there.
There you go.
That was fun. And I get to follow these advanced students around, or they're actually in their exams now. They're beyond the student level and doing their exams. And they've got all these, there's a rescue farm that supplied all these little tiny horses that God knows who bred whom and all that. You know, we'd have to do blood tests, I think, to know who belongs to what families there. But they're all just sweet and wild, like little feral cats and running around. And these girls are having so much fun. I mean, I went to dinner the other night with three of them, and I was like, well, here's what we do. We get up in the morning and we talk about horses, and then we get out there and we play with horses. And at the end of the day, we ride horses. It's horse camp. This is great. So they're not too nervous. I think they're having a really good time.
Oh, that's
till Monty comes, maybe.
Well, yeah, then everybody has to straighten up just a little bit.
They have to do their exam at the end of this, so they have to pay attention. But anyway, it's been fun to watch them. I mean, talk about pure language of equus. A wild horse has no other language. They only know that we're predators and they don't want to be near us because they're neophobic. They're afraid of everything. And it's interesting to watch that gentling process happen and that trust start to build and fear on their parts. I don't see much fear in these gals' parts. They're really, it's all women in this course. Not by design. It's just our industry is taken over by women, pretty much, which is great. It's great for the horses. I think they're, you know, they tend to be, horses know that there's testosterone versus, I think the estrogen is not, doesn't guarantee us that we're good with horses, but I think testosterone probably just gives up a vibe of predator a little bit more. So I think we do have an advantage as women. We're empathetic and nurturing as well, but that doesn't guarantee anything either. We also have to get in our muscle memory about the language. So
yeah. So that makes gets me to thinking, because for the exams you use what I would call clean slate horses that are not broken to ride or lead or have their feet picked up.
That's true.
As clean a slate as possible. This is a wild guess. Is one of the reasons you do that so that each candidate has what I would call a level playing field? It's not like, oh, well, you got such and such horse. He got chased around by a guy with a rake for 6 years. Of course, he's really hard to work with.
Yeah, that's true. Well, yeah, you've been watching The Road to the Horse, so you know what that looks like, where you're trying to sort of pair them up and make it fair and everything too, which those are great. That's hard to do. Yes, it is. And I suppose that there is, I'm not the head instructor over there at all. And I don't even know the thinking process on it, but I think the whole point is trying to, they do try to match the students with a horse that is safe enough for them. I'm not sure how Denise Heinlein is our head instructor here right now from Germany.
She's the master chef.
She is. She cooks the recipes up over there. And I think she's pretty fair about it. Now, Jamie Jennings is on the exam course right now, or whatever we're calling it. It's the advanced exams. And she said she's been here like 10 times now, taking different courses and everything. And I hadn't thought about that. She's been to some Night of Inspirations and other things where she's not hands-on. But she has a lot more exposure to watching all this language than some some other people might. We do have the Equus Online University, which should level the playing field too. You should have access to Monty 24/7. You know, they really, they are streaming. There's 500 lessons on there right now. So you really can get into his concepts and his psyche about horses. But there's nothing like muscle memory. There's nothing like being out there in the
pen. It's still horsemanship, and you still need to go out and practice. So
absolutely. At this level, super high level. Yeah.
For the average Joe, like me, who only has just the tiniest inkling of the understanding of the language of Equus, because I have not studied it like Jamie has, is there a significant difference in how it is, for lack of a better word, spoken, or how it is perceived by the horse with a horse who is a clean slate, a Mustang or a completely feral horse, versus a horse who spent the past 6 years getting chased around a round pen with a rake?
Is there
a difference there?
Pitchforks and all that stuff. That's a great question. Yeah, it's a great question. There is. I definitely think there is. And that's why the project horses that these students get, the advanced courses full of project horses, it doesn't mean that you won't learn as much from a horse that's had bad experiences, either rescue, hoarder, you know, situations and everything. So it's either neglect or abuse, being the worst, I think, because anything that has a horse that has endured pain at the hands of a human is definitely less trustworthy than a horse that was just abandoned in a field and was not, you know, didn't have any groceries. So it's that negative reaction to a predator. I mean, it's actually verification that a predator will eat you. So when we hurt them, you know, we're just affirming what they already believed in the first place. And so, yes, a horse that is a rescue that has been abused will definitely have many more scars and much more lack of trust, you know, distrust of humans than another. It's interesting too about the language of Equus to speak to that purely, like, what is that? You know, what is it? Is it born in the DNA, or is it something socialized amongst horses? Is there a difference between a wild horse, you know, a Mustang that grew up in Nevada versus a horse that grew up in a field? Well, yes, and yes, and yes, and yes, and all those. But, the horse that's born in captivity or born domestically, which is, you know, most of our horses these days, they're acclimated to humans, and they're, you know, so there's no big surprise or nervousness about has a human eaten them or not, you know, when they're babies. So it's interesting if you could have, and here I've got a real life example actually, if you could have a horse that was born blind, remember their language is silent, a horse that's born blind, if he got his sight back, he regained his sight later, would he know his language? So, you know, that kind of tells you whether it's DNA. And of course there's DNA in there about, they're definitely flight animals, you know, and all that stuff is survival. But there is part of the language that is actually learned in a social environment, which tells us to leave, you know, the horses in social environments with them, their herd, as much as possible. But there was a horse that dad got wind of that was going to be taken to Colorado State University to have cataracts removed. And he's a few years old at this point. He was born blind because of these thick, milky cataracts that were over his eyes. And he was with his mother, raised like you would any other, given that he was blind. But and then dad said, you know, before you do this, could you please keep me informed of what's going on? And I'd like to be up there when he's first healthy and brought, you know, back into a situation where I can work with him a little bit. So they did. And he didn't know his own language. He had no concept about advance and retreat or anything like that. So it was really interesting that a lot of that language then, that the eyes on eyes and the crossing the body axis and keeping our fingers closed, open, well, if you open your palms, that means go away. So you can do that. He didn't know what that meant. You close your palms, you close your fingers, anything that looks like a claw kind of thing, and the horse would relax. Well, he didn't know any of that. He didn't have a clue. So it's interesting about the language. When those gals are out there working in their exams, the horse will teach you so much about your mistakes. You know, if all of a sudden your eyes start snapping on them and you just forget to move with like you're in heavy oil, is what the term that we like to use. You've seen all this in the pastures yourself, right?
Yeah.
You've played with all, could take that conversation from there. Imagine that times 100. You know, that's what these wild horses are like. You're playing with Scooter or Nigel out in the field just to see what their
They no longer have an innate fear of humans like a blank slate horse will. The blank slate horse doesn't have any experience to draw on to tell him that he shouldn't be afraid of this here predator. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So Dad always says that, Monty Roberts, it always says that a horse has a flight mechanism that's actually a deer has a flight mechanism that's 100 times what a horse is, but a wild horse has probably 100, you know, a wild horse like a Mustang has 100 times what our domestic horses are. One little curious thing that happens that we notice between the wild horse and the domestic horse, and I'm talking, you know, like a yearling out of the fields or something. So one that's not trained or anything, but we're talking a domestic horse raised around humans. They whinny around here all the time, our domestic horses. If you bring in the Mustangs, when we adopt these, you know, 3 or 4 or 5, what we do every year, they come in here and they're absolutely silent. Absolutely. They don't whinny. They don't scream to each other or anything. And that's because in their predatorial environment, that would mean death.
Yeah. I often think about that. I always associate whinnying with something that foals do in order to find mama. They kind of panic. Oh my God, where's mommy? And they whinny.
That's true. I'm over here.
And when you have a horse that, we're going off topic, so I'll try not to do this too long. Horses that are at the very far end of being buddy sour. That horse that if you take the horse in the stall next to him away, he melts down and turns into a puddle of mush and screams his lungs out, and he does it for 6 hours.
Yeah.
That always reminded me of the reaction you would have if you took the mare away from a 3 or 4 month old foal. And I often wondered if horses that have that propensity, and I've come across horses that just don't get over it. You can take away the other horse for 3 days and they're still pacing and screaming in 3 days. If those horses don't have the horse version of some kind of an arrested emotional development, and the two horses, I've only ever had two horses that did this, were raised in that classic competitive atmosphere where they had very, very little interaction with other horses.
Yeah.
You know, they went from mommy to take away. And then after that, you don't get to talk to other horses because you're a racehorse or a show horse and you don't get to have those reactions. And I often wonder if horses that are raised that way are more likely to be buddy sour than horses who are raised in a very.
I don't know. I mean, and there's different sensitivities in horses too. I mean, we just went down to Temecula and Dad was in the Masters series down there with Boyd Martin, the Olympian. And so we took two horses there that we thought, well, one that Boyd could do a join up with, a really nice horse of my mother's. And then another one, who is just kind of a Dad's riding horse and just a quarter horse buddy horse for him, but they actually don't spend any time together. They're in different areas of the farm. And it, just the drive from here, which is Central California, to Southern California, 4 or 5 hours, they were so buddied up.
Best friends. We had put
them in different barns. It was ridiculous. And they were screaming to each other. And I mean, literally, they'd never interacted before. So, you know, some are more, and those horses are completely, I mean, they get lots of horse time and everything with other horses. So it's not like there's some crisis of personality in them. It's just that I don't know what it was. Je ne sais quoi. It was some chemistry between them. They got, you know, some sort, and they both travel a lot, you know, go to shows separately. I don't know.
They were sharing coffee on the way and they were best buddies from the get-go. There you go.
Yeah. It could have been the LA freeways. Maybe it was like a traumatic thing. All that stop and go.
Yeah. I've been on LA freeways. It is traumatic.
You know what I mean? But anyway, we should get to our show. We have some wonderful people coming up here. We've got Catherine Burke, an equestrian photographer, and we got Bill Farish, a legend. I mean, that family, Lane's End Farm, with Monty Roberts speaking about horses.
Your horse is your partner in sport, in leisure, and just in life. To keep him at his peak performance and optimal health, a solid nutritional foundation is key. Ideally, horses are able to graze fresh, growing grasses, which most closely mimic their natural diet. But that may not always be possible, and we may need to supply some of those missing ingredients in today's diets and provide more functional foods. One component of a horse's diet that is often underfed are omega-3 fatty acids. While more prevalent in fresh forages, harvested forages are lower in omega-3 fatty acids due to their more advanced maturity. Obviously, grasses and legumes have to grow to a sufficient height in order to be harvested, while foraging patterns of horses show great preference for shorter, less mature plants. That's why modern horsemen and horsewomen trust Omega Horseshine to provide a powerful, bountiful source of omega-3 fatty acids for their equine partners. Look for Omega Horseshine from Omega Fields at your local tack and feed supplier, or you can find them online at omegafields.com.
As much a storyteller as a photographer, Catherine Burke finds magic in the everyday. She gathers light, color, and texture to create memorable images. Inspiration comes from her lifelong love of horses and a desire to share their spirit, power, and grace, as well as the joy they bring to their guardians.
Well, welcome, Catherine Burke. I'll use your stage name. How are you?
I'm great. Always nice to hear from you.
So nice to hear from you too, Kate. And it's been too long since I've seen you. I know we meet at very auspicious places and it's always a lot of fun. But
I wouldn't say it. Who said odd places? Excuse me for interrupting
auspicious.
You.
Auspicious.
Auspicious.
Grand rooms at the Equine Affair or grand fields out in the Santa Barbara County or, you know, very auspicious places. But it's always fun. It's always fun catching up with you and meeting with you. And I just wanted people to get to know you a little bit today. This is the first time we've had you on Horsemanship Radio, but it certainly won't be the last. And we've got some big plans coming up in 2018 to be together. So I'm very excited about that.
Yes. But
yeah, aren't you? I'm very excited to have you as part of our symposium and festival. And but we'll tell
I'm
people.
Very about honored to have been invited. So I'm excited too.
You will do such justice to it. So, but I wanted people to get to know you a little bit first too. So, I've read some beautiful things about you. Some people have written some very nice articles and I want everybody to know that you're a horse girl at heart. And how far back does that go?
A long way. The first time I saw a horse was when I was about 3 years old in St. John, New Brunswick, where I started, there was a fellow who used to come around with a little black and white painted pony. It was a real horse, but it was a pony with a little Western saddle on it. And they'd put the neighborhood kids up on it and take their picture. Everybody had pictures of themselves on ponies when they were 3 and 4 years old.
The same one.
The thing to do.
Yeah. And then I know that you started working with horses, though, at age 9. Well, cleaning stalls.
Cleaning stalls. And I was sort of the go-to girl to catch the horses because I had developed a really strong bond with the horses. That they were half Arabians that were in a barn in the neighborhood. And I just spent every waking minute at that barn and helped with preparing the winter sweet feed and cleaning tack. And I got some riding lessons once in a while. I cleaned stalls and the horses were just my friends. And I just played around in the fields with them all day by myself, just me and the horses. And I did that for about 4 years. So I was totally in love, of course, head over heels like anyone. And that's where I started actually taking pictures because the horses inspired me. So mm-hmm. I had a little Instamatic camera with a little cube flash on it.
Right.
I would take pictures of the horses with these little, I can't even remember what they would have looked like, but I just remember that that's where I started taking pictures.
That's so cute. I mean, it's so cute that you say pictures too. I love that a professional photographer who's had her work published all over the world doesn't say photography. You say pictures. It's just so cute. It is very
systematic. They were snapshots. They were snapshots.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? Can you wind back and think what was it about horses that drew them to you? Or vice versa, drew you to them?
I think the the most obvious is that they are gentle giants. And when you're a little girl, you're nine years old and probably about 4.5 feet tall, if that. And these huge animals are so gentle that you can maul them and brush them and give them treats and play with them in a field, and they don't hurt you and they trust you. And that is so, it's so empowering, I think, for a child especially, but really for any woman. I think women have a really strong affinity for horses, and I think that is part of it, that they empower us by being friends with us and being malleable and tractable, and they allow us to work with them in such a way that we can, I hate to say control, but we do. We control them, but they're willing partners. And I think they're just a wonderful, powerful, beautiful animal.
I don't think you can make them. Yeah, I don't think you can make them do anything they don't want to do, even.
Right.
So, yeah, so they trust you enough to be your willing partners. Yeah, right. Well, they're very trusting of you, because you get into some very beautiful scenes and shots and intimate moments with them. And I, you know, you remind me, when I see a lot of your photography, and I hope people will just stop this podcast right now and just go to your website and look at it, the beautiful work too, and then come back and listen to this. But they're almost Rubenesque. You know, there's this big scope that you have to so many. Is there a breed of horse that you think cannot take a bad photo?
An Andalusian.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Cannot take a bad picture.
Can't take a bad photo, right?
No.
All that mane and all that butt and everything. They're just beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Just hair and muscles. A horse with hair and muscle and presence. The one thing that I find I maybe don't care for in the Andalusian and the Lusitano, I love them, but they don't have that huge expressive eye that an Arabian would have, or some of the warm bloods have beautiful eyes. And that's the only thing. Otherwise, when you're taking action pictures or photographs, the Andalusian and the Lusitano, they cannot be beat. They just are marvelous. And of course, you know, people will argue a warm blood that's being ridden beautifully in dressage, of course, is magic. But for a Liberty horse, just a running wild that's going to capture everyone's heart, it's going to be the Andalusian every time.
Yeah,
unless you're a blubber.
I looking at your photos, yeah, I agree with you. So your subjects are pretty broad, though. I mean, some look like scenes out of Game of Thrones or like Lord of Rings or something. But but then I see vaqueros on Arabians, and I see barrel racers on quarter horses, and you don't stay to any one subject or even one breed.
No, and I think that part of it is that a lot of these photos that I take are done in the Weisel workshops with April Weisel, and she arranges the models and the horses. And so we're given these subjects and beautiful opportunities in locations and costumes, and just you can't go wrong. They're just amazing shoots. And then on the other hand, I have been shooting at the Calgary Stampede, which I'm an English rider myself. I'm not a Western rider, but I do love cowboys. And so I did have a media pass at Calgary Stampede a couple of years ago. And I had so much fun shooting the rodeo. Really is amazing and energetic and inspiring in a photographic way, because there's just so much vibrance to it.
Colors and the costumes.
The colors. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's just fantastic. It's just something that has to be seen to be appreciated in person, seen in person. But I think that the fact that I shoot everything and that I don't stick to one discipline, like I do realize there are photographers who specialize in dressage or in rodeo or in horse racing, and I don't specialize. And I think it is probably a reflection of how I ride, because I just like to have fun with my horse, and I'm not in any strict discipline. I don't jump. I don't do dressage. I do a bit of schooling, but I mostly just ride out in the open country with my horse, and we just enjoy running, galloping, cantering, trotting, walking around in the countryside and through the woods, and just enjoying being together. And I think that because of that, because I'm not in myself involved in any one discipline, mm-hmm. it opens up my appreciation and my desire to shoot anything that yeah. involves a horse.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So I saw on your website too, that you did a shoot with Sheila Varian, and I think a lot of listeners will know we've interviewed mm-hmm. her before she passed, and she has such a she's an icon in the Arabian horse industry. But you shot her as a vaquero woman, which she considered herself. What mm-hmm. was that? How did that happen? How did that whole experience come about?
Well, when I go to California, I usually always am attending a Weisel workshop, and April Weisel had been friends with Sheila Varian for many years, and also the people I stay with, whom you know as well, my friends Lee and Rick, are good friends with Sheila, were good friends with Sheila, and so I had met her through them, but I also just by chance was able to do photo shoots with her through the workshop. So I knew her on two different fronts, and it was just loved going up there. Have you been to her ranch? You must have.
Gosh,
been to
it's been
ranch,
years. Do you know we grew up next to each? Well, I was a baby, but we grew up in San Luis Obispo, so we were very close to the Varians when
right,
I was very
right.
young.
The
yeah,
whole family.
But it's been years. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I had also been at a cattle drive with her cousin Jack.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Varian's ranch, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the B6 ranch.
Yes,
I had
B6.
Done a cattle drive with them.
That's
and
so fun.
Everyone is sort of related out there. Anyone
yeah.
who's in horses seems to know everybody else. So
we are, especially in the San Ynez Valley and those counties up and down the central coast. Yeah.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's just so exciting to go out there because there are so many cross connections between all the different breeders, owners, trainers, regular people, but all the horse people and people who like wine, of course.
Yes, it's sort of a combination there too. Dogs, wine, horses all goes together.
That's right. That's right. I always say, they'll say, where are you going when you go to California? I say, I go to horse and wine country. That's all
yeah.
I can.
That's exactly, and everybody knows where that is. It's pretty cool.
Everybody knows where that is. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I would love for you to tell readers or listeners where we first met. That is all part of that story too, and where you met Dad, Bonnie Roberts, on that, what was it, a spring day back in, I guess that'd be 2009, I think, when we first
2007.
met. 2007. Seven, okay. There you are. It's longer
yeah.
than
that. I'll never forget. It was a Tuesday.
Oh, you're
Tuesday
so funny.
Morning. It's true. It's true. I can't forget it because it is, as I think we were speaking of the other day, it was a turning point in my life. And I wanted to do this podcast because I wanted people to hear this story, because it is such a cool serendipitous event that changed my life forever. One day out of many, many, many days that I had been alive, this was one day that changed the course of my life. And I think it's quite inspiring in that it would show people how easy it is to actually change your life with a simple decision. So I'll tell you how it happened. So I drive down the main drag through Santa Ynez Valley, where I had driven back and forth many, many times, and past Flag Is Up Farms, Monty Roberts Farm. The other people in the workshop with me who had been driving with me, we had noticed that this was Monty Roberts Farm, and we'd commented on several times, well, Monty really needs to meet us, making jokes. And as I was driving by that morning, it was still very early, I noticed a sign on the gate that said, visitors welcome. And it was the first I had noticed this. And I said, visitors welcome? That means me. I'm going to go in and see this farm. That'll be a little excursion. So I come up the driveway and park, and there's a film crew in the yard. And I thought, well, if there's a film crew, Monty Roberts must be here. So I started talking to the director, Austin Atkinson. And I said, do you think he'd mind if I took his picture? He said, oh, let's ask him. So Monty comes out, and I said, would you mind, sir, if I took your picture? Oh, no, you go right ahead, but I got to keep moving. I got to keep working here. So they shot this segment, and I was taking pictures and just having fun. And then Austin came over to me, and he said, listen, you look like you know what you're doing. Would you like to do the still photography for this 13-part miniseries we're doing, this California segment? I said, yeah, sure. So he asked me to do this shot, and I got all the shots he wanted. And 4 o'clock came, and everyone was saying, well, I think we're done for the day. So I said, okay, I'll see you later. I'll email you. And this is where I met you, because you were there, of course, because you're the manager. And you were so sweet. And either you or Austin or both of you said, well, Monty's going up tomorrow to the Madonna Ranch to ride with the wild horses. Do you want to come up and shoot? And I said, well, yeah, sure. So 8 o'clock the next morning, we're driving down the driveway, and I'm on the phone to my mother saying, guess where I'm going, Mom? I'm right behind Monty Roberts, and we're going up to the Madonna Ranch to shoot wild horses.
I think I nicknamed you my little angel at that point, too, because you were just so sweet, and you just were such a trooper. Sure, she's willing to go. She's got her camera. Here she comes. So,
oh, that was a lot of fun. It really opened my life to a great extent, and my world is much bigger now than it was before, and all because of that one day. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, of course, that I got to meet Monty Roberts and photograph him, and I've run into him a couple of times since then, of course, at Equine Affair with you, and I've been to the ranch after that at Flags Up Farms with you and your mom, your wonderful mother, who's an amazing sculptress.
Another artist. There you are.
Another fabulous artist. So
you're going to be our guest artist this May too. We'll let people in on a bit of a secret that we're going to have a symposium and festival in May at the farm, and Catherine Burke will be an artist in residence at that, and it'll be really fun. You know, your life, you kind of live life one decision at a time, which I love about you, but you have so much mileage behind you now in the photographs. It's sounding like you live life like a line that I read about you one time, that you said that I never depend on my camera to make decisions for me. I always shoot in manual. And that mm-hmm. sounded like the decisions you were making about being on the farm and being out with the horses. When you did, you were ready for that opportunity because you were prepared to be ready for mm-hmm. an opportunity. What does it mean that you always shoot in manual though for your camera?
Well, people who shoot SLRs, which is single lens reflex camera, whatever it is. You know what I mean? It's a 35mm camera that you can make adjustments on, and it takes lenses. You can change the lenses, and that's basically what an SLR is. Now it's a DSLR, which is digital. But anyone who shoots like that, they know that we have certain priority settings that you can use to you can just set the camera to say, I want every shot to be this speed, and you're going to decide on what the exposure will be and so on, and the depth of field. You're going to decide all that because I want to make sure no matter which direction I point this camera, I want the speed to stay at this speed. Or you can say, I want the camera to always shoot at this focal length, and I don't care what the settings are otherwise. It can be a slow speed or a fast speed, doesn't matter. You're going to make the decisions. But if you want to really get a great photo, you have to control the camera and tell the camera, no, I want it to be this speed, and I want it to be this f-stop, and I want it to be this exposure. And if you tell the camera everything, then the camera can't make any decisions, so that when you turn it into the sun, it doesn't suddenly say, oh, it's too bright, I'm going to have to darken everything down. I'm the one who decides if I want it to be dark or not, because I make all my settings myself. That's what it means. It's more of a technical thing when I say I don't let the camera make decisions. So this is just mm-hmm. for your photography listeners who understand.
No, I love that. I love that. I think that's actually a good lesson for a lot of us who do a lot of things in technology on autopilot, because we don't take the effort to actually learn all the foibles of your, yeah.
If you're interested to know the very basic rule of a camera, it's that a camera really doesn't see anything in shades of gray. everything is black and white to a camera. So when I say that, I mean it in a, more of a figurative way. But in truth, they used to say when I started with on the internet, when I had access to other people discussing photography in a great field of people discussing, they would say, when you go out to shoot a client, make sure you tell them not to wear a white shirt, especially if they have a black horse. What happens? Well, if you point the camera towards the white shirt, the camera will say, and this is because they're using these automatic settings, if you point the camera towards the white shirt, it will say, oh, that's very bright. I need to stop down the exposure. Then what happens is your horse is so dark, you can't see it. If you point it at the horse is black. And so the camera will say, oh, I need to brighten this shot because this is very dark. And so the white shirt will just be washed out, completely gone, and there will be no pixels at all. So there'll be no information there and it'll be blown out. Well, who wants to live like that? When you when you want to take the picture you want to take, you're going to have to tell the camera, I'm going to tell you where I want this. And it's going to be somewhere in between dark and bright. It's going to be right in the middle so that the shirt is great and the horse is great. So you don't want the camera changing every time it hits on something that's bright or dark. It will switch, and you don't want that to happen. So if you have it on manual, it does exactly what you tell it to do, no matter where you point it.
I love a woman in control. That's perfect. That is a great explanation.
I love to be in control.
As you should, because what you produce, we don't want to change anything. I have one crazy question for you, because you are just such a Renaissance woman to me. If you wanted to travel back in time, I'm picturing, what do you want to really photograph? What is it your heart's desire? What era would you want to photograph in?
Well, I'd love if your listeners got in touch with me if they have this for me. I really want to photograph traditional side saddle women riding in Victorian dress, which is sort of an up and coming thing. It's coming back into vogue where women are picking up side saddle riding. And there are women in England, especially, and I believe in Virginia and Maryland, who are hunting in side saddle with Victorian dress, because that is the traditional dress with the long skirt and the veil over their face and a top hat. Very, very elegant. And I'm just dreaming of having a shoot with a woman going cross country over the shrubs and the fencing in Victorian attire, side saddle.
I think
that's
my
dream.
With that one.
Oh, Jen, our producer can help you.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Well, you have to send me that information because I'd love to set that up for next year.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. There is nothing more inspiring than traditionally attired hunt fields cruising across the countryside. Oh, gives me goosebumps.
I absolutely love it. Love it.
Have either of you ladies seen Downton Abbey?
Of course.
Well, yeah.
I mean, Mary. Of course you did. Mary fox hunts side saddle, doesn't she?
Yes, in the first season
there's
a famous scene. I think it's about the third episode where she is shown fox hunting, and of course she is side saddle. But
and she's beautiful too.
Yes,
yeah, Mary's beautiful.
All right, we're gonna set this up.
We'll get it. We'll get you set up, girl.
Oh, I love it. Love it. Thank you. I'm glad that came up. That was a good question.
I'm glad you had a great answer. It's a beautiful thought. It really is. And I would love to see a Catherine Burke photo of just that. Mm-hmm. It could be fun. In fact, video, I think. Actually, I want to see him going over. Well, this has been so fun, Kate. I really appreciate you taking out so much of your time, too. You're very busy. And I know it's late there. You're calling from where are we calling you?
I'm in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, East Coast.
My goodness. Yes, all the way.
Northeast of Maine. A lot of people don't know where it is, but it's northeast of Maine, and it is just west of Nova Scotia.
It is so far east of here. You're in a time zone. I forgot there was an extra time zone.
Extra time zone for sure. It's Atlantic Standard Time, so we're an hour ahead of New York.
Exactly. Exactly.
We're that much closer to England and Greenwich.
And I love that you come out all the way to the West Coast every year. And I can't wait to see you in May. And I can't wait to have you back on to hear about your photo shoot with the side saddle fox hunting.
Oh, beautiful. Then, you know, if that's going to be the case, I'm going to have to take notes. I will make notes for the next one after I do this shoot.
Yeah, sure. You're fine. Jen actually has some experience with the fox hunting, so you guys will put you two together, and we'll get this done right.
Woo-hoo.
It'll be beautiful.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's so much fun to have you on Horsemanship Radio, Kate, and we'll be talking to you real soon.
Such an honor for me to be asked to talk to your listeners, and thank you very much for listening to me. That was fun.
You're great. You're great. Great stories. Thank you. All right.
You're super. Thanks, Debbie. Thanks, Jen. Bye-bye.
Hi, Carol Herter here, president of Cavallo, home of the world's most trusted and popular hoof boots. You know, one of the most interesting parts of what I do is the many horsey stories I get to hear. Most of them are really uplifting. Some are stories of challenges, and a few are downright sad. Recently, a wonderful woman took the time to approach us at a show to share a story about her horse who went down in quicksand. It started out as a really scary story. We were holding our breaths, waiting for the outcome, and it turned out wonderful. They winched the horse out relatively unscathed, albeit, you know, a little traumatized, and everyone standing around were super amazed that he still had his Cavallo hoof boots on. Scary story with a good ending. Another testament to Cavallo. If you don't have a pair for your horse, it's time. Cavallos are easy to put on, easy to take off when you want to take them off, and they stay on. They stay on in all terrain. Cavallo, the world's most trusted hoof boots.
Will Farish Jr., Bill, has served 9 years as the chairman of the board of the Breeders' Cup and is currently the general manager of Lane's Inn's Farm, which has the global stature that no other North American operation exceeds, with services tailored for every aspect of the sport, breeding, auction representation, and bloodstock counseling, too. Lane's Inn has an extraordinary record at the sales as the leading consigner on 26 occasions and as the seller of more than 365 stakes winners, including such champions as AP Indy, St. Liam, Rags to Riches, and Lemon Drop Kid. Well, welcome, Bill Farish and Monty Roberts. I am so excited to have you two on because we want to be flies on the wall and listen to two legends, really, in the industry of thoroughbred racing. And Bill, I'd love to start with you. The reason to be here today is to celebrate that both you and your dad, William Farish, have decided to align with WOA, which is the Water Hay Oats Alliance. Am I right?
That's correct, Debbie. We've been observing WOA for a long time and agree with almost all, you know, and always have agreed with almost everything they were doing, but their support of what's going on in Washington right now is really what was the tipping point for us. And we just have been so frustrated over the years with the lack of uniformity in our drug policies in this country. And we finally have a way, we think, to federally mandate it. As you know, we've got 30 some different racing jurisdictions in this country, and every state runs under different rules and allows different things with different withdrawal times and everything else. And it's just been very, very frustrating to get all the states on the same page. And we finally have a way to do that.
That's fantastic. Well, I know horse enthusiasts are sure happy to hear such strong personalities now being involved. Before we go too far into WOA, from your perspectives, I should give the listeners just a little background. The thumbnail version is that WOA stands for Water Hay Oats Alliance, a grassroots movement of like-minded individuals, I'm reading this here, who support the passage of federal legislation to prohibit the use of performance-enhancing drugs in the sport of horse racing. The appointment of an independent anti-doping program run by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency will solve the problem of widespread drug use in American racing and put U.S. racing jurisdictions in step with international standards. I think that sets the tone for today's talk between you two. And this is where I'll bring Dad in, Monty in, and give us a little background on why you threw your weight behind WOE a few months ago too, Dad.
I did indeed, Debbie, and I'm pleased that I did it, but it didn't come easy for me. It took me a long time and a lot of investigation before I would go there, and I can give you reasons for that if you want to go into it in detail.
Sure. Yeah. Well, give us at least an overview. Yeah.
Well, as you know, I led the world for 18 years in the production of young horses through two-year-old sales. Not the yearling sales, but the two-year-old sales. I had the number one consignment for 18 years. And I met a lot of veterinarians along the way, and I listened to them and heard their spin on the use of Lasix, for instance, in the process of getting horses to race without bleeding into the lungs. Mm-hmm. And I heard all of the arguments for and against. I recognized the fact that a lot of the veterinarians and other people were saying, if you had a child that bled into his lungs when he was running around the schoolyard, and you had a chance to give him something that keeps him from bleeding, you'd give it to him.
Yeah.
And the horse is the same way, and it made sense to me. You give it to him and help him. The veterinarians were making a good deal of money selling this principle, and soon we had about 98% of the horses in the United States running on Lasix. And I asked the question a lot of times, why would so many? All these horses can't be bleeding, 98% of the horses. Well, I was told 86% of the horses bleed to one extent or another in the process of running a race.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that by prominent veterinarians who were making a good deal of money selling the substance. And I believed them.
Yeah.
And I won't name them, but some of them were very prominent people. And when I learned that, yes, it's true that you can microscopically find a dot of blood because that's how the thoroughbred is made up. And in Dubai, I was addressed by a very good veterinarian who showed me a slide and introduced me to the fact that the thinner the alveolar sacs in the lung case itself, those are the little cells of oxygen that are pushed into the blood. The thinner the walls are, the more oxygen that goes through to the bloodstream. And we breed the fastest to the fastest. And that means that those really good horses have a thin wall.
Sure.
And during the course of a race, those walls will leak a little bit. But while 86% of them can be found to bleed slightly under the microscope, it's only about 5 or 6% who actually bleed enough to really be concerned about. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that until the last couple of years. And I went right back to that most prominent veterinarian and said, he was retired by then and off to another profession. But anyway, I said, what the hell were you telling me a few years ago about 86% and this and that? He said, well, you know, Monty, we're in business too, and it's true that 86% can identify blood, but actually 5 or 6% are the only ones that really needed the Lasix. Well, then why was 98% of them receiving Lasix?
Mm.
Well, it seems as though it's a little difficult to find some other substances when they are smudged over or protected by a coating of Lasix. Mm. Makes it more difficult to test. And also, we got paid to give them the LASIK, and the trainer said, we told the trainers, give them LASIKs and they won't bleed. And certain trainers found out that they could give some other performance enhancing drugs that would be masked by
the LASIKs.
LASIKs. Yeah. So I said, well, I'll be doggone, you guys. And he said, look, I don't want you to name me, but that's a fact, and I'm not proud of it. And I called Arthur Hancock in 5 minutes and said, I'm on. For the betterment of the breed, top to bottom, woe's the way to go.
Yeah. Well, and for me, Debbie and Monty, it's not just about LASIKs. LASIKs is certainly a major issue in our country, and you know, we are the only major racing jurisdiction that runs on LASIKs and runs graded races on LASIKs. So it is a troubling thing that we're that out of step with the rest of the world. But it's other drugs as well that we may or may not know are being used. And what this bill in Washington is pushing is a third party that conducts all the testing in the country, and to the same standards, at the same standard of laboratory, which is another problem that we have here. It's we have no consistency in our labs.
Do you agree to, or as a team, do you agree that the genetic pool is weakened if we don't do something about this?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I've heard both sides of that. I've heard that, obviously, you know, any breeder would not want to breed a known bleeder to a known bleeder. That is something one would avoid, but I've also heard it takes really generations to breed, to change the breed. So, you know, but as a breeder, I don't think, you know, we announce that horses are cribbers, but we don't announce that they're bleeders.
Right.
And it's something that most breeders would not want to perpetuate for sure.
Well, what I love about Lane's End though, is that I'm seeing you talk about different things that are attributes of the thoroughbred. You have some, obviously, we've read some off in your intro, some of these amazing horses that you've had over generations now. And you talk a lot about the girth, the size of the girth, the heart, the lung capacity, other things. So just touching on that subject alone, I think that's what you're leading people to look for. And I would love to ask both of you, really, what you love to look for in a yearling or a two-year-old. You guys are legend. You've seen champions after champions over the generations. Monty, Dad, I'll go to you too. What do you look for in a yearling that you believe makes greatness?
Well, Debbie, as you probably know, I've written extensively about the triangle, the relationship of the pelvic girdle to the shoulder, and the fact that those two muscle masses are the largest in the horse's body, and they are responsible for getting the horse up the racetrack. And if they're not symmetrical and working in unison, the horse is less likely to be an athlete and a winner. So I use the triangle a lot, but I just want to hearken back, Debbie, to that last statement a little bit, because, you know, in the business of using drugs of any sort, LASIKs or otherwise, there's a lot of people that would say, if you can get me a fast horse, I want to breed thin wall to thin wall. I don't care if it bleeds or not. I'll fill them up with LASIKs and run them if they can go fast. And so you could change the genetic makeup, that's for sure. But you know, what I've concluded is I don't care whether it changes the genetic makeup or not. If they bleed, they bleed, and they should suffer the consequences of bleeding so that we breed to the strength of the horses involved, as opposed to the weaknesses of the horses involved.
regardless of how they run. And if they're on water, hay, and oats, then that's the horse, genetically and physically, psychologically, and in every way. So I don't care if it changes them or it doesn't change them. If survival of the fittest means if it changes them, we won't be using that horse if you can't use LASIK. So, and the other drugs too, So, I look for the pelvic and shoulder arrangement, skeletally speaking. That's just an idiosyncrasy of mine. That's how alleged came to be. Everybody has their preferences, leg alignment and all that. But Bill, I'll let you say what's your favorite measurement.
Yeah, well, Monty, I wanted to ask you a question along those lines. How much do you try to look at their mental state? An area you obviously known for helping horses with. Is that part of what you're looking at when you look at a yearling?
Yeah.
Or a two-year-old?
Sure. If I go to a yearling sale, Bill, and I see a horse that's cranky and out of sorts, if I see a horse that's extremely nervous, one that runs a high pulse rate, high adrenaline levels, wants to fuss with human beings a lot, I'm not going to like him as much as I do a horse that's amenable and cooperative toward human beings. But in all honesty, Bill, be careful with that one, because human beings affect that idiosyncrasy far more than genetics do. And sometimes I can recall buying horses that were absolute or acquiring horses maybe from some other owner that were absolute killers as at the yearling sale. And you get to handling them right, and they have a better personality in there than we ever thought they did, you know? So I
sure,
think a lot of that has... What?
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of it is the environment, too. They're taken from a farm environment and taken to a sale and shown over and over and over again. And they get tired and cranky, and that can show up at the sale when it wouldn't normally be there at home.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's very true. Also, there are some people that would use growth hormones and mind-altering substances when they take their yearlings in there, overgrown and stuffed with all kinds of sugars and starches that would alter the behavior of a horse. So you do want to be careful. Analyze cross-spectrum as much as you can. But, when I bought Alleged, he looked like he was dying tomorrow,
Starving.
Well, yeah, Lee Eaton had him in consignment, and that really threw me for a loop, because Lee Eaton produced horses that were in good shape and always looked good and everything. And I said to Lee, what is going on? Well, he said, Monty, this poor bugger, he suffered a 5-hour surgery to correct an umbilical hernia, and he came out of the thing and he wouldn't eat, and he weighed, at when I got him home, he weighed 712 pounds against most of the yearlings I bought that year would average about 1100 pounds. So he was just a rack of bones, but that allowed me to see his skeletal structure. And 7 months later, I'm a genius, and I got $175,000 for him. Which is nice, but then I wasn't a genius, because 24 months later they syndicated him for $16 million. So
definitely on the right track.
Well, and I've got you on the line, Bill. What are you all looking for in your whole operation, because you guys really cover the gamut. You have stallions at breeding. You've got the full package there at Lane's End. So what's your philosophies these days in looking for horses?
Well, it depends on what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we have yearling colt packages that we do, racing packages that we're looking for stallion prospects, you know, for those racing partnerships. And we also do filly partnerships. We tend to keep them separate. Some people like to go the filly route. It's a little less risky, and so we'll do that as well. And you know, we're probably looking for the same thing as Monty does, but a slightly different way. We really put a lot of emphasis on the walk, which you know, I think exactly what Monty was saying. If you have the triangle right, you're going to have the good walk goes right with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we're really looking for is fillies that can, you know, do, you know, hopefully win graded races and either go to the broodmare ban or be sold to dissolve that racing partnership, or in the colts situation, obviously we're trying to make stallion prospects for Lane's End.
Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. So you've been Breeders' Cup chairman. Now, you were chairman through 2016, I think. Is that right? Or are you still chairman?
Through the summer of 17. So just last summer.
Okay.
Shut down.
Yeah. So,
hey,
yeah.
Debbie.
Yes. Yes.
Let me throw kind of a humorous question to Bill, okay?
Good. Yes, please.
Bill. What's the most famous customer you've ever had at Lane's End Farm?
Well, that's probably hands down would be the queen.
Ah, there you are.
No.
Yeah.
No.
What name droppers?
I think you knew the answer to that one, Monty.
I knew the answer to that one because I speak with her about it a lot, and she remembers Lane's End Farm fondly because she spent more time there than any other place in Kentucky.
Right. She stayed there five times. Stayed here five
yeah.
times. So.
I'm starting some of the bloodlines that she acquired through her customership with Lane's End Farm. And it's fun for me to go back through those and to remember, you know, how she bred this mare to that stallion and so forth and so on. So I started all the babies just this last month in England.
Oh, the month great. Of, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the month of October, actually. And, yeah, I've been starting all of her babies for 9 years now, she's doing progressively better all the time. She doesn't have that many mares, you know, and it's not that large an operation. It sounds like it when they put it in the newspapers and stuff. But this lady has been such an influence for good in the world. It's just amazing. And to think that you had her as a customer and to think that she was instrumental, I think, in appointing your father as ambassador to the UK, it's just quite an honor for me to know both sides of that coin.
Yeah, I've got to echo everything you're saying. She is an amazing person and so knowledgeable in our sport. I always have to brush up before I.
Yeah, that's right.
she's going to stump me on something almost every time.
Yeah.
When did you first meet her, Bill? Did you meet her as a young boy or?
Well, I was pretty young. I guess I was still in college the first time she came to Lane's End. And you know, back then there really weren't the kind of depth of high quality stallions in Europe that there are now. So she was really coming over here to scout stallion prospects to breed her mares to because there wasn't much over there at the time to breed to. And this was back in the mid 80s. And she, it was a working trip for her. She was staying at the farm, but you know, every day was full of stops at different farms, looking at all the stallions in central Kentucky.
Yeah.
So it was all business, and she you could tell she was totally in her element the entire time. She just loved it.
Yeah. If anybody doubted it, there you are. Yeah.
I bet you guys were concerned about security and stuff, weren't you?
There was, you know, there's always that concern, but, you know, being in the middle of a farm, it gives you a pretty good layer of security. And there was, you know, the U.S. Secret Service was involved and special branch from over there was involved. And it was we never felt any concern about it.
That's good. So I know, I think Dad might not know this, but you two know somebody equally, Andreas Jacobs. Wasn't he on your committee as part of the Breeders' Cup?
He was, yes. Yeah. He's on the, I think he's still on the big board, the larger Breeders' Cup board, and has been involved with the Breeders' Cup for quite a while.
Speaking of European breeders, and Dad just got off his November. What year are you in now, Dad? 27 or something of going over and starting all the Jacobs babies?
I'm just moving into the 27th year of starting all their babies, and it all began in 91 with Loamy Tufts. And
Yeah, you know.
I didn't realize that. I didn't realize you were doing that much overseas. That's great.
Pretty much. It's hard to keep
them
here.
That's about all I do.
Is that right?
It's about all I do. I do far more overseas than I do here in California or the United States, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't allow me to get to Kentucky enough. I really miss it.
We're trying to do that.
I left here September 15 and just got back day before yesterday. So, and that was England, Germany, Austria, and Hong Kong. So, yeah, they keep me busy.
He signs up for it, Bill. So one thing I wanted to do too is finishing up on the WOA or the Water, Hay, Oats Alliance too. I got to feeling that others who hear this and are hearing what WOA is doing out there, Stacey Hancock has been so huge in beating this drum and getting it going. What can people do? What are others that feel the same way? What are they doing and what can people do listening to this?
Well, first of all, they can join WOA. It's free to join. And you can, there's over 1500 members, I believe, it's a grassroots movement. And that's the first thing they can do. The second thing they can do, if they agree with this federal path we're taking on medication, is they can call their representatives and urge them to support this bill, because it's not easy to get things passed in Washington. It's very easy to keep things from getting passed, but it's tough to get legislation passed. And I really feel like this bill is gaining momentum.
Great. Okay. Well, good. We'll put a link in there in the show notes so people can do a little more homework if they need to, or just get on board. I think there's enough heavyweights like you all behind it now
I can echo those sentiments of Bill, and look what we've been through with the Tennessee Walking Horses and can't get legislation to stop some of the most god-awful treatment on the face of this earth. So, it's hard to get things through, and it's easy to get things stopped.
Well, thank you both for lending your weight, your accomplishments and everything behind WOA. And I'm sure Stacy is super thankful. And I know that horse lovers, horse enthusiasts are super happy about this. You know, this really helps the thoroughbred industry, I think, who sometimes from outside looking in believe that the powers that be don't think of the horse. And this is all about the horse. So I love what you're both doing. And I appreciate you sharing a little bit of your story. And I'd love to have you back too to talk about some milestones that WOA is making and some sticking spots, if we can push them through to help and keep it going.
Well, you got me.
I'd be happy to do that. Got me too.
Whisper the language of the herd. Listen, you don't have to say a word.
It's time for Jamie Jennings to fetch an email from Monty Roberts' inbox and share a morsel of Monty's wisdom in a little segment we like to call Ask Monty.
Leave this world a better place than mine. The magic in the language of the herd.
Dear Monty, I rode and owned ponies as a child, but gave up in my teens to study and socialize. I'd like to take up riding again at 67, but I am so very nervous when riding. I've been told that Icelandic courses have a wonderful disposition for the senior rider. I would be grateful for any advice you are able to give me, as I enjoy horses so much and want a positive experience. Monty's answer. I think every breed has individuals that fall into the category of being safe and bomb-proof. Having said that, every breed also has its share of challenging individuals that might be less than safe and reliable. The Icelandic horses that I have worked with certainly have the capacity to become gentle, steady, and sensible. The gait of the Icelandic is fine for a beginner rider. They're smooth and comfortable when properly trained. I have now worked with probably something over 500 Icelandic horses. On this basis of experience, I feel qualified to express the opinion that with proper schooling, the Icelandic can become a very good choice for a horse person in their senior years. The gait of the Icelandic is called the tolt and is similar to that of several other breeds, the walking horse, the Missouri fox trotter, the Rocky Mountain horse, and of course the Peruvian Paso and the Paso Fino, to name a few. Without personal experience, I have it from reliable sources that the tolt and other gaits of this kind offer a ride that is smooth, comfortable, and level with the ground. It is said that you can take a glass of wine with you and never spill a drop. These folks go on to tell me that the tolt is much less likely to cause a rider to be muscle sore from the experience. The most important piece of advice that I can give you is whatever horse you choose should be a safe individual no matter what breed it is. Color, breed, or other aesthetic virtues should be way down lower on your list of priorities than safety. The second consideration should be health and soundness. Then we go on through a list of about 20 important aspects in selecting an appropriate horse. It is crucial that you get this decision right, as it will affect your relationship with the horse and your own safety and enjoyment for a long period of time.
For more of these insights into good horsemanship, go to www.montyroberts.com and click on the orange banner that says Get Free Horse Tips.
Hi, I'm Monty Roberts, and I'm dedicated to training horses without pain. You can learn to do it too on my Equus Online University. Western, English, the beginner, or the advanced rider, it doesn't matter. You can connect with other students online too on our forum, and there's a new lesson every week. It's a lifetime of learning for you on my Equus Online University at MontyRoberts.com.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Yeah.
Where in the world is Monty Roberts?
Monty is looking forward to meeting some new friends, two-legged and four-legged, in England. March 3, he's going to be at Myers Cove College. March 7, he'll be at Hadlow College. March 17th, this is a favorite, The Grange, with special guest Martin Clunes. And then March 24, he hops over to the Ireland, little island over there. What do they call that? The Irish island. And that's the March 24th will be near Dublin. Look on the calendar for that. And then April 21, he's back here in California at Thousand Oaks. It is the continuation of that master series that we spoke of with Boyd Martin. It's called the West Coast Dressage Convention. And that's right in Central California. May 23 and 24, we are really excited about something we're calling the Movement. It's part symposium and part festival, and we'll have certified instructors from all over the world meeting there to help demonstrate, but we're calling it Demonstrations, Discoveries, and Pathways. And then May 25th to 27, we have the Horse Sense and Healing here in the California location of Flag Is Up Farms. And then July 23 through August 3 is a Gentling Wild Horses course here at the farm. And then August 6 through 10 is our annual Monty's Special Training.
And if you didn't get all that committed to memory, you can find all that and so much more at the website MontyRoberts.com, or you can give somebody a call right there at Flag Is Up Farm who will answer the phone and be kind and helpful. And the phone number there is 805-688-6288. And for details about today's show, Go to horsemanshipradio.com where you'll find links, photos, and more information about today's guests. And we love your feedback. It helps us make the show better, gives us clever ideas to talk about things on the show. So go to Facebook, type in Monty Roberts, and click on it. It's the one with the little blue check because it's the official one. And follow Monty Roberts online. Or if you're a tweeter, you can follow him on Twitter. And his handle is Monty_Roberts. Now, once you've done all that, make sure that you have all of your favorite Horse Radio Network shows with you wherever you go by downloading the free Horse Radio Network app for your iPhone or your Android. Just go to your app store and type in Horse Radio Network and download it. It's quick, it's free, and it's easy. Or you can listen via iTunes or use your favorite podcatcher. How do you listen, Debbie?
Yeah, I actually go right to your app.
You use the app.
Mm-hmm. That's so easy. Easiest way to do it. Yep. And I get to see all the other shows because I have to kind of remember, Kai, you have so many shows. Like, what do I want to listen to in this car ride? So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anybody in California should be listening to podcasts.
Oh, so true with all that traffic. Sorry. It's true. And many thanks to our sponsors, too. That's Omega Fields, Cavallo Horse and Rider, and MontyRobertsUniversity.com. Be sure to visit all the other great shows, too, that I spoke about on the app on the Horse Radio Network at www.horseradionetwork.com. Until next time, have many happy horse hours.